Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
So what I'm doing is I'm watching you, and I'm... Are you watching me? Are we just watching each other?
I mean, ideally, just gazing into each other's eyes. Okay. Yeah, I'm absolutely watching you. Actually, I'm kind of watching me.
Ah.
Because look how cute I look.
I mean, you look great.
All right, well, I think that worked, so here we go. Witch, please, gone rogue! Hello and welcome to Witch Please, a podcast about the Harry Potter world. I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Marcel Cosman.
This week, oh, this month, this this installment of season 3, Witch Please Gone Rogue, brings you an episode very much in the shape of many of our season 2 episodes, where we are going to bring in some audio from a live event recorded elsewhere. That live event in this case is a keynote that Marcel gave, and I wasn't even there, so I don't even know what she said. And so I'm really excited to listen to it because I think that Marcel is really smart and interesting.
Aww.
I'm going to tell you and our dear listeners the same thing that I told the audience at this talk, which is that I'm really just using Harry Potter as a secret way in to just tell you about my research. So it's like I talk about Hermione for about 6 seconds and then I'm like, ha ha, Canadian pulp magazine history, suckers.
I love that. Psych. Oh, I can't wait, because you know what I also love?
What?
Canadian pulp magazine history.
It's pretty cool.
I love it a lot. I'm very interested in it. In a lot of ways, I feel like Witch Please as a project was a Trojan horse from the beginning, mm-hmm. where we took a horse made out of Harry Potter books, mm-hmm. and we stuffed it full of secret feminism. Just 1,000 handmaidens of feminism, mm-hmm. crouched inside a horse made out of books. Is yep. this metaphor working?
It's working great. And then I'm right. imagining it like trotting through Harry Potter fandom land, just pooping out feminism everywhere it goes.
I don't think the Trojan horse is animate.
I'm pretty sure that's how the soldiers got out. Otherwise, they would know it's not a real horse. Duh.
Oh, I should know better than to put on eye makeup before recording one of these episodes. I'm a fool. I never learn. Okay. So will you tell us a little bit more about what the actual event was that you gave the keynote at?
Yeah.
Sorry. at which you gave the keynote.
Mm, thank you for correcting that. I was going to have to fix it in post. Here's a hot tip for all of you young podcasters. It's not worth your time to splice up your sentences to fix your own grammar. Oh.
I have, on the very rare occasion, made the effort when I have misspoken, made the effort to say, to find the correct word elsewhere in the podcast and splice it in, and it always sounds bad.
Yep. Yeah, I know. I've totally been there. And especially in our first season.
which we are retroactively dubbing Witch Please, keeping it on the rails.
Witch Please, so legit.
Witch Please, we were so much younger then.
Witch Please, I hadn't even done my candidacy yet. Actually, wait, that's not true. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to reassure you. I don't know where I get off saying
Are you sure of myself? Yes.
May I for a moment gaslight you about your own life? Okay. Tell me about your goddamn keynote.
To answer your question, I was invited to give the closing keynote for the annual ABQLA conference. And the ABQLA is l'Association des Bibliothécaires du Québec, Quebec Library Association. So
is this keynote in French?
Yep. Surprise. I'm just kidding. No, it's not. Yeah. I did, when they first invited me, have a small fantasy about giving at least a portion of the keynote in French, but I couldn't have answered any questions in French, and so it seemed really disingenuous to, you know, present myself as bilingual when I'm semi-lingual.
Semi-lingual.
I'm semi-lingual.
That's why I speak two languages half. Yeah. So I think that means that I speak a total of two languages. I speak one entirely and two a bit.
Yeah. That's great. That's two languages.
It's fine. They invited you to speak about Harry Potter and you were like, nice try, suckers.
I mean, actually, technically, they invited both of us. But you were doing something very fancy in Vegas?
Not in Vegas. I think that was just... Oh, it was regionals, which my chorus came in first in, and my quartet came in last in.
Still on the map.
Yes. No, I was here. I was here for the Sweet Adeline's Women's Barbershop Regional Competition.
Very cool.
Can't do keynotes. Have to wear the same dress as three other women.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was great.
I mean, it was great for me because it meant that I got to sneak in a talk about my own research.
Yes.
Which was great.
Yeah. So do you think the people know in general what your research area is? The people.
I mean, I don't even know what my own research is, so...
Liar.
So I, so my dissertation research is about early Canadian women's science fiction and fantasy writing, and so that includes a period known as Canada's Golden Age of pulp magazine production. And so the talk that I gave was largely drawn from the second chapter of my dissertation, where I talk about the pulp magazine history in Canada and why it's sort of complicated.
Yes. Do you interrogate at all, or have you, or has anyone, this notion of a golden age?
I think that scholars who write about the period critically, by which I mean not just doing like a fluff piece for a magazine.
PR for 100 years ago.
I think it's really hard to talk about it as a golden age without being a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because it was less than a decade long. It was like closer to 5 years, And the government reacted so swiftly and thoroughly in an attempt to crush it that Golden Age is very generous. Also, yeah. It was like, I can't remember the turn of phrase that I use in my dissertation, and I'm actually not sure if I use this in the talk or not, but it's something like a bunch of opportunistic newspaper expats who came out of the woodwork to start this pulp industry. It was really like people in their kitchens. I mean, I don't know if it was literally their kitchens, but like back alley operations to print,
yeah,
you know, 75 copies of a really shitty tabloid magazine, yeah, that is largely plagiarized from an American periodical that they smuggled over the border.
Yes, the rich golden age of Canadian periodical publishing. It has literally never been better than that. So,
truly. Yeah.
Sorry, people who make Canadian magazines. There are many excellent small Canadian magazines in Canada.
It's true, but those are either little magazines or slick magazines. The pulp magazine era was like deliberately trashy, and you know, I think if we're talking about trashy magazines, I think it is fair to say that Canada truly had a golden age of making trashy magazines.
What's the trashiest thing Canada makes now?
What a good question. Have you ever been to St. Catherine Street in Montreal?
No.
Okay.
I mean, probably.
It is a street that is very bougie, but then the further east you go, it is just all sex shops and strip clubs and really gross bars. So I would say that that area is probably never mind, I take it back. It's definitely Crescent Street, where all the American tourists go when they turn 18 to get really, really drunk.
Just that street is the trashiest thing Canada makes.
Yeah.
Great.
Actually, no, I take it back. White Avenue. I just remembered where I live. White Avenue in Edmonton, which is covered in vomit like four out of seven days a week.
Covered in vomit. It's wild.
Yeah. So I would say the bar culture is, is the trashiest thing culture, that Canada makes right now.
I really thought that you were going somewhere like vis-a-vis print culture. You're like, on St. Catharines, there are like these local like tabloid newspaper. Nope.
It's just the street.
Just the place.
Just bar culture in general. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think is the trashiest thing that Canada makes right now?
Oh my God. I mean, there's a lot of particular human beings I would like to point at, but I'm not going to because I've already gotten in trouble for naming them on podcasts.
What?
So instead, you know who they are. And so instead, I'm going to say, so I right now, when I was in Regina in May for the Congress, the big Humanities and Social Sciences Conference in Canada, I met up with a bunch of the women running a protest camp on the legislature grounds, and it's called Camp Justice for Our Stolen Children. And there's a number of women there, including Satin Denny, Colton Bushy's sister, and they are protesting the lack of legal response to the high rate of murders of Indigenous people, particularly in Saskatchewan. And they are doing really amazing work. So they've set up teepees and they have a sacred fire going, and it's a safe space where other Indigenous people can come and talk to them and get support. And then also it's a protest camp, so they're trying to get like movement from the legislature. And I'm Facebook friends now with one of the women who I interviewed for that episode, and she posts on Facebook a lot of the racist responses that they are getting for their nonviolent protest camp, including a number of white folks in Saskatchewan proposing that they should implement a shoot an Indian day.
I've seen that.
That's I think the trashiest thing Canada's producing.
I think that is the clear winner. No competition on that one.
I mean, but a street full of vomit is also in its own way an extension of like white supremacy, patriarchy, and capitalism.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
White Ave is not unsaturated with its own violences.
Yes. I will grant you that. Oh man.
Yeah. Bringing it down. So that's my theme song.
It's good. It's a good theme song.
Thanks.
It's very, very 2018.
Thank you. The theme of 2018 is me wearing a unicorn top and bright blue eyeshadow while talking about the violences of white supremacy. I think that's the most 2018 thing I could be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. 2018 is weird, right?
Yeah. It's really weird. It's just like, what's her name? Lisa Frank?
Mm-hmm.
It's like Lisa Frank and fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Together at last.
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah.
So, trash.
Trash.
Canada has produced a lot of trash. Mm-hmm. Why do you explain in your talk why you are interested in the trash that Canada has historically produced?
That's a good question. I don't think I answer that per se. But I talk about how I talk a little bit, but I'll talk more now about the fact that when I started this project, the history of Canadian women science fiction writing. I was really excited about uncovering all of these forgotten feminist texts. And I was really excited to see how that feminism had developed over time. And I was really excited to celebrate that history. Right from the very beginning, and this actually probably won't come as a surprise to anyone who is familiar with the history of white feminism, but these early feminist texts are extremely racist and classist, because at that point in history, the dominant feminist discourse was racist white imperial women who wanted to make Canada a white empire, or who wanted to make Canada a white nation. Mm-hmm. And whiteness was a very exclusive concept that only applied to certain people with certain characteristics and certain behaviors. And it was pretty remarkable to me. I was very naive when I started this project, and I've learned, I mean, weren't we all before? Well, no, we weren't all. Some people knew what was up. I was not one of them. Anyway, I was very naive when I started this project, but I have since come to learn that even the exciting world of science fiction, which has so many opportunities for imagining things differently and resisting commonplaces and opening your mind to new and better worlds, was used and deployed as a method of white supremacy in its, mm-hmm. Even now, but also definitely.
Yes.
Definitely at the turn of the century, before science fiction was even a genre.
Do you remember the Sad Puppies protest of a couple of years ago?
Does this ring a bell? Sounds familiar, but I don't. Help
me out.
It was
when, so the big sci-fi literary award, the Nebula, is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Is, unlike most other major literary awards, it's done by vote rather than by like an expert jury.
Okay.
And so I guess a bunch of white dudes who were used to sort of dominating SF as a genre were outraged by like a women of color who had started winning these awards, and were insistent that it was just political correctness ruining their genre. And so they tried to organize like a collective, like they basically tried to game the voting system by like organizing online to get a whole bunch of people to swamp the votes, so that like typical, particularly military science fiction, like, which is a very popular genre with a particular kind of reader. Like, they tried to push all of that into the winning positions to beat out the, like, black women who were, like, owning these awards recently. And anyway, it didn't work. And N.K. Jemisin won again.
Amazing.
Because she is better than all of them combined. But, like, that history, like, it's so rooted in SF as a genre, right? Like, the way that, particularly as, like, not in, not futurism or speculation as genres, like, those are more amorphous and have other kinds of possibilities, but, like, the publishing history of SF is so rooted in white supremacy.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. When, so, Hugo Gernsback is sort of known as the, like, father of science fiction as a genre because of his magazine. I think it was Amazing Stories. Somebody listening
right now. Is the Hugo named after him?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And he, it was really important to him that, okay, sorry, how do I want to describe this? Because, okay, so before the internet and social media and all of those things, people communicated and ideas circulated in letters to the editor columns, right? And so science fiction and fantasy as genres really were developed by the communities of people who were reading and writing. There was like, that's why fandom is so important in those genres in particularly, and less so in like realism.
Yeah. Literary fiction doesn't care as much about its fandoms.
No. And so, people were actually, when these things were brand new in the 20s, people were actually contributing to conversations about, you know, well, what should we publish in these magazines? What kinds of stories are we looking for? And that was really how the genre became born. And for Gernsback...
Really thought you said that's how the genre became boring.
I mean, well, no. But for Gernsback, it was really important that the thing that made science fiction or scientific fiction, which it was called, which is disgusting.
I wish that it caught on. I'm so gonna start,
don't
I'm
even
start
try to
it
say
that.
It. It's so gross.
Scientific fiction.
It's terrible.
Scientific fiction. No.
He felt that it need that the science needed to be real and believable. And if you think about who had access to science education in the 20s, it wasn't a lot of women, and it was definitely a lot. It was definitely not a lot of people of color, irrespective of gender.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why our sort of dominant understanding of science fiction has historically been like largely produced by white men. It's not that women of color, it's not that people of color and women in general haven't been writing it. It's that the genre sort of became structured around these like, I mean, this is why material history is so interesting, right? Because like, oh, actually, these people made decisions that produced real consequences.
Yeah. And also made decisions about like when you pair the history of science fiction publishing with the history of the sort of disciplinary evolution of science. Yeah, so that sort of that historical moment around the emergence of science as something that again could only be practiced by white men, that, you know, is tied in all kinds of ways with like imperialist notions of knowledge production, and that thus disavow structurally knowledges that we could absolutely consider to be scientific, but that emerge from spaces outside of the imperial center.
Totally.
So like there's all kinds of, I mean, that's why like indigenous futurism and Afrofuturism are so exciting because they offer for like, how do I want to put this? Like for me as a reader who grew up reading like Robert Heinlein and like white men's science fiction, I find genres exciting that like actually offer me a view of a different world rather than an extrapolation of the world that I was already told was the way things are.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And whenever people get twitchy about what constitutes science, like what constitutes the science in science fiction, I really want to remind people that there are a lot of things that we used to consider science, which mm-hmm. are pseudoscience. And so like phrenology, for example.
I was going to say phrenology.
It's my favorite example. The science of like people's skulls and what that tells you about their personality and type of character they are. Like that has been debunked, but it was extremely important in like, I don't know, like the late 19th century.
Yeah.
Eugenics, another great example of a science that is not real, but was extremely important as a scientific practice to racist and imperialist white people.
Yeah, so it makes a lot of sense that science fiction, sorry, scientific fiction, would be like a particular sort of like hinge for like white supremacist ideals and imperialism and how it's getting worked out and gender politics and how they're getting worked out. Like all of that sort of centers around both around sort of science as it's emerging in like the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And then also like always around publishing, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, again, why material history is so fascinating, because you can really in concrete ways understand something about how knowledge is created and how the possibilities of knowledge are like foreclosed, which is also part of Hermione's journey in the Harry Potter books.
Truly.
Her journey into becoming a person concerned with material culture and the origins of texts.
Exactly. That's a great transition. Let's go.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. As a visitor from Amiskwatsi Waskahigan, Edmonton, Treaty 6, and Métis Territory, I want to begin by echoing the recognition that Concordia University is located on unceded Indigenous lands. I recognize the Ganyankehaga Nation as the custodians of the lands and waters on which we gather today. It is a great honor and privilege to be back in Jiljage, Montreal. Thank you so much to the ABQLA Programming Committee, and especially Catherine Hands for reading so many of my emails, for inviting me to give today's closing keynote. It is a pleasure to be here. The significance of being invited to give a keynote while still a PhD student is not lost on me. Moreover, to be invited to give a keynote because of my podcast on Harry Potter feels to me to be a momentous thing indeed. With this talk, I'm going to bridge two more or less distinct areas of my work, my Harry Potter scholarship, if you will, and my research into early Canadian women's science fiction and fantasy writing. I want to do this by thinking through the ways in which Hermione Granger models reading. Hermione is, of course, the true hero of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter novels. The brightest witch of her age, her careful study and keen intellect blazes the path for Harry to find and defeat the Dark Lord. Throughout the series, Hermione's journey takes her from a devout, pious reader, dedicated to the authority of the written word, to an inspirationally critical reader. This shift comes quite suddenly, as I see it, in the fourth book, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Here, Hermione learns that Hogwarts is home to about 100 house elves, and she is aghast. The fact that Hermione doesn't know about house elves at Hogwarts is huge, because Hermione knows everything about Hogwarts. And why doesn't she know? Because house elves aren't included in the book Hogwarts: A History. Over the previous three novels, Hermione has drawn on Hogwarts: A History constantly. Her deep familiarity with its 1,000-plus pages makes her as expert as the school staff, and, in some cases, even more so than the Weasley twins. We can attribute her ignorance to things like the Chamber of Secrets, the tunnels into Hogsmeade, and the reason the Whomping Willow was planted in the first place to the fact that these were non-institutional changes to the school. But house elves are the lifeblood of a well-run Hogwarts. To exclude them from the official record of the school is not only a glaring omission, for Hermione it is a tremendous betrayal of trust. We know this because the next time she refers to Hogwarts: A History, she says, quote, "Of course, that book's not entirely reliable. A revised history of Hogwarts would be a more accurate title. Or a highly biased selective history of Hogwarts, which glosses over the nastier aspects of the school," end quote. Of course, Hermione doesn't stop reading Hogwarts: A History. She just stops taking its authority for granted. This, I think, is key. Hermione's response to a highly biased and selective history book isn't to forget about it, or ban it, or burn it, but to read it differently. To read it with the knowledge that it is implicitly biased. In other words, Hermione learns how to read symptomatically. Symptomatic reading is something we do all the time without necessarily knowing the term for it. It's more or less just reading things while keeping their social and historical context in mind. The term comes from the French theorist Louis Althusser, who proposed to read Karl Marx's philosophy symptomatically in order to understand its underlying ideologies. I won't pretend to be thoroughly versed in Marx's literary criticism because I'm not Hermione, but I find this Oxford definition to be quite useful. A mode of reading literary and historical works which focuses on the text's underlying presuppositions. In particular, it tries to determine what a particular text is unable to say or represses because of its ideological conviction. So when Hermione describes Hogwarts: A History as a highly biased and selective history of Hogwarts, which glosses over the nastier aspects of the school, she is coming to realize that books aren't just informative. They are tools that reproduce the systems of power that organize our society. As one might expect, after coming to terms with Hogwarts: A History, Hermione goes on to model a brilliant and kaleidoscopic ability to conduct symptomatic readings. This experience radically transforms her relationship to all manner of printed text. In Book 5, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, Hermione reads the entirety of the ministry-mandated Defense Against the Dark Arts textbook. She concludes, correctly, that its emphasis on theory without practice is a deliberate attempt to disempower students. Further, she carefully analyzes each issue of the Daily Prophet newspaper to stay knowledgeable about the increasingly fascist rule of Cornelius Fudge and the slow Death Eater infiltration of the Ministry of Magic. Meanwhile, Harry, a classically terrible reader, gives up on the prophet because it doesn't tell him what he wants to hear, and as a result, he misses the newspaper's strategic invocation of his own name to turn public opinion against him. Harry. Now, you might rightly ask about Hermione's refusal to deviate from the instructions in her potions textbook in Book 6, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. And this is a fair counterpoint, because at this point, she should know that textbooks aren't necessarily reliable. But at the same time, she is able to see the latent violence in the mysterious Half-Blood Prince's marginalia in Harry's potions textbook. We as readers instinctively side with Harry, whose devotion to the prince's marginalia has enabled him to outshine Hermione in potions class. That is, until Harry nearly murders Draco in the bathroom by using a spell from the margins labeled for enemies. A critical reader might have asked, what kind of high schooler has enemies? But Harry can't read critically, and so he assumes the spell is a relatively harmless hex or jinx and not a murder spell. Hermione would never have made this mistake. This is pure speculation, but I imagine that if Hermione had gotten the Prince's Potions textbook instead of Harry, she would have tested every one of the annotated recommendations and then written a strongly worded letter to the publisher to explain the many improvements their 30-year-old textbook requires. And no one would have been almost murdered in the bathroom. The last example I'll give here, though I'm happy to talk about more over drinks later, is Hermione's willingness to read Rita Skeeter's trashy, unauthorized, post-mortem biography, The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore. I think this example is splendid. Even though the genre of the book is easy to dismiss as tawdry, sensational gossip, Hermione reads it anyway. She knows that knowledge of Dumbledore's story is mostly gaps, and so for her, the biography isn't so much a fact sheet as it is an archive, rich with letters and anecdotes, that might enable her and her friends to piece together what Voldemort is after. She certainly doesn't accept it at face value as a tell-all in the way that the book is marketed and poor Harry is manipulated into believing, but rather approaches it as a reflection of their current political and social moment. So we have to remember that as far as anyone knew at this time, Dumbledore was the victim of a political assassination. He was the main antagonist of fascism in the wizarding world, and his death marks a tipping point in the balance of power between mainstream ministry democracy and Death Eater fascism. Hermione knows Rita Skeeter to be a prolific and controversial writer with a keen sense of the zeitgeist. She knows there's no way Skeeter would have written a book that could endanger her life or her career, and so Hermione must recognize the book as intentionally non-threatening to the fascist political regime vying for power. Of course, this isn't to say that Skeeter would have written a less sensational book had it been a different time, and probably not, based on the way that she wrote about Harry in the Goblet of Fire. But we don't need to speculate when taking into account the specific conditions that produce the book while also interpreting its contents. For Hermione, the book isn't proof that Dumbledore lied to or manipulated Harry. It is merely a book meant to discredit an anti-fascist that was published in an increasingly fascist time. As a critical reader, Hermione is unhindered by either devotion to or distrust of specific authors, genres, or even literary forms. Does she retain prejudices with respect to those things? Undeniably. But she shows us the value of reading across genre, form, and even authorial reliability in order to have as much information as possible. The Hermione Granger who sits in the snow reading The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore is my favorite example of archival praxis. It is completely and utterly unsurprising to me that all of the time and care she puts into her Dumbledore research ultimately hinges on a tiny incidental mark she just happens to notice and a picture of a young man whom Harry thinks maybe he's seen before. This, at least in my experience, is archival research to a T. Not having a clue what you're looking for, but looking anyway because you know there has to be something. Not knowing what to ask about or whom. Taking random chances, defying death, fighting giant snakes. Why they have giant snakes in Library and Archives Canada, I will never know. When I started my PhD in 2012, I wanted to compare contemporary Canadian women science fiction to proto-science fiction written by Canadian women around the early 20th century. I wanted to see what these texts could tell us about the development of Canadian feminism over the last 100 or so years. Only it turned out I couldn't do this project because no one, not a single person, had published anything about early 20th century science fiction written by Canadian women. What if there wasn't any? I had just assumed that there would be, but suddenly I realized how foolish that was. I had never heard of any early Canadian women science fiction. I had never read any early Canadian women science fiction. And come to think of it, neither science fiction nor fantasy showed up in any of the CanLit anthologies I'd used during my undergraduate and master's degrees. Maybe Canadians didn't write science fiction until the 1980s. Maybe Margaret Atwood invented Canadian science fiction. Impossible. It seemed to me to be impossible that this was the case. But, like Hermione, I had nothing to go on other than my sense that there must be more to the story. And so I did what Hermione would do. I went to the library. Actually, I went to several libraries. Library and Archives Canada with the snakes. The Merrill Collection of Science Fiction, Speculation, and Fantasy at the Toronto Public Library, and the Bob Gibson Collection of Speculative Literatures at the University of Calgary. My first trips were a bust because I didn't know what I didn't know, and it led me to a number of false starts. But I made the best of it, and gradually I came to learn that Canadian women did write science fictional literatures as early as 1896 and all the way through the early and mid-20th century. But the vast majority of these works were published in American magazines. 5 years of archival research later, I have unraveled what feels like an elaborate conspiracy theory about the absence of science fiction from what we call CanLit. It's not that science fiction, even in its nascent form, was uninteresting to Canadian women writers. The issue is that most genres, as we know them today, were developed and refined over decades in pulp magazines. But pulp magazines posed a moral and political threat to Canada's class hierarchy and were forcibly eliminated from the Canadian cultural landscape. This is where the conspiracy comes in. For the next 20 or so minutes, I'll walk you through my research, which looks a little bit like this, and then bring it back to Hermione's journey and how this juxtaposition helps me to understand my own work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
If ever there was an audience that didn't need convincing about books causing a moral panic, it's librarians. I imagine most of you are probably familiar with the anxiety that comic books caused among guardians of children's moral development back in the 1930s and 40s. What you may not know is that Canadian pulp magazines experienced an almost parallel fate, and as a result, forestalled the incorporation of popular genres like science fiction and fantasy into what we call CanLit until well into the 1990s. Before mass market paperbacks, the pulps were low-cost and cheap-quality fiction magazines printed on pulpwood paper from which they got their name. They had few advertisements and brightly colored sensational covers. They were extremely affordable and very popular. Unlike more recent moral panics about children's books, Harry Potter promoting witchcraft, for example, the panic that both comics and pulp magazines induced in Canada was deeply interconnected with cheapness. That is, early 20th century moral guardians saw clear associations between cheapness and immorality. It's true that the depictions of violence in comics and pulps caused an uproar amongst parents, teachers, librarians, and religious figures, but this focus obscures the broader campaign against cheap reading materials that was motivated by an elite condemnation for lowbrow reading, and, I believe, a concurrent anxiety about social and cultural power. If we follow the genealogy of cheap reading materials from comic books and pulp magazines back in time to dime novels, penny dreadfuls, and even 19th century story papers, we find a parallel genealogy of elite disapproval over the kinds of things working-class people like to read. Essentially, rich people have been worried about poor people's reading habits since the emergence of the printing press. Working-class literacy, in particular, poses a threat to the cultural and economic systems dependent on proletarian complacency, because a literate proletariat is able to write, consume, and circulate seditious texts. In the 1930s and 40s, the Canadian state sought to define itself as a strong, unified nation, not only independent from Britain, but in opposition to the growing influence of communism as well. Catherine defines the 1930s America communism binary as, quote, one of the most powerful ideological oppositions of the 20th century, end quote, so much so that the terms have become mutually constitutive. The Canadian government's maneuvers to control pulp magazine distribution in Canada during this period can and should be understood in relation to the state's contemporaneous anxiety over a possible working class revolution. This is not to say that pulp fiction necessarily aligned with revolutionary politics. Generally speaking, the American pulp magazine industry actually reinforced class hierarchies. Michelle Smith explains that it was commonplace for American magazine owners to subsidize the production of their middle-class and elite magazines with the profit margins from pulp magazine sales. In this way, Smith argues, pulp magazines, quote, could be exploited as a base commodity that funded high culture, much in the same way that the mass labor of typical pulp readers supported the power and elitism of the upper classes, end quote. An excellent example is the American hard-boiled detective pulp, Black Mask, whose sale after a mere 8 published issues, allowed its owners to subsidize the production costs of their elite magazine, The Smart Set. Now, this was not the business model for Canada's pulp magazine industry. Canadian pulp magazines were produced entirely independent from the existing magazine trade, and as a result, provided no financial benefit to middle-class and elite cultural producers. Until the 1940s, there wasn't much of a Canadian pulp magazine industry to speak of. The American pulps were well circulated throughout Canadian cities, with Canadian readers making up about 10% of American pulp sales, which is around 1 million issues per week in the 1920s and 30s, according to Smith. This wasn't a market that Canadian magazine producers were willing to tap. Then, on December 6, 1940, the Canadian government passed the War Exchange Conservation Act, a trade embargo on consumer goods produced outside of what was known as the Sterling Area, which was made up of countries that either used or pegged their currency to the pound sterling. The embargo included things like chocolate, playing cards, and pulp magazines. The pulps were widely known to be the primary reading material of the working class, and scholars like Michelle Smith, Carolyn Strange, and Tina Liu all point to the classist nature of the embargo, given that middle and elite class magazines, those were called slicks, would continue to be imported. In fact, the phrasing of the War Exchange Conservation Act gave the Minister of National Revenue discretion over which items were desirable and may therefore be afforded a permit to enter Canada, and which ones could not. In banning pulp magazines, but not slicks, the Act capitalized on what Smith calls, quote, the inferior class status of the pulps, combined with the belief that the pulps promoted moral degeneration, end quote. This allowed the rationale for the pulp embargo to be both moral and economic. Rich people can keep spending money on American magazines, but poor people can't because cheap magazines are bad. In practical terms, Smith explains, the War Exchange Conservation Act enabled the federal government to control, quote, the reading matter of Canadian citizens who possess the least degree of economic and social power, end quote. In a surprise turn of events, the Act precipitated a surge of Canadian pulp magazine production. As I mentioned earlier, this new pulp industry operated radically different from its American counterpart. It wasn't Canada's established magazine industry that took advantage of the void in the periodical market. It was a handful of upstarts and opportunistic newspaper expats who came out of the woodwork to capitalize on the massive demand for pulp magazines. They set up small-scale publishing operations and produced scores of low-brow periodicals completely independent of the Canadian magazine trade. And they were tremendously successful. Michelle Smith writes of one example, Alec Valentine's Alval Publishing Company, which grew to have numerous subsidiaries, and explains that between 1941 and 45, quote, Valentine's Publishing House sustained itself with the monthly production of 15 top-selling true crime magazines and 4 crime fiction magazines. Further, at the publishing house's peak in 1943 to 45, Valentine was publishing up to 44 different titles on a monthly basis, end quote. At their core, these Canadian pulp magazines served as a de facto threat to the dominance of elite cultural production. It's important to remember that during the 1940s, Canadian cultural sovereignty and national sovereignty were increasingly seen as the same thing, and so a threat to one was necessarily interpreted as a threat to the other. The success of this rogue cultural industry meant that, irrespective of the ideological content of the pulp magazines themselves, an independent pulp publishing industry proved the possibility of an alternative to Canada's class hierarchy. But what if Canada's pulp publishers were actually just communists? The details get a bit murky, but there is reason to believe that at least some of the big players in the Canadian pulps were socialists or communists. As I already mentioned, the American pulp industry was owned by mainstream magazine producers and wasn't, in and of itself, a revolutionary medium. But during the 1930s and 40s, there was a major ideological divide in the American science fiction community, and this produced 2 major fan associations: the Science Fiction League, which was stridently non-revolutionary, and its spin-off association, the Futurians, who saw science fiction as an opportunity to imagine new worlds and new social orders, which is kind of the thing that we understand science fiction to do. So the Futurians were largely commies and Trotskyists, and their works were published regularly in Canada's main science fiction pulp, Uncanny Tales. Uncanny Tales was the only Canadian science fiction pulp magazine to last for a significant stretch of time. It was edited by a man named Melvin Colby and published by Adam Publishing, which was a subsidiary of the Alval Publishing Company. According to an anecdote by noted anti-communist Sam Moskowitz, a writer and literary agent who headed the New York branch of the Science Fiction League, so the non-revolutionary one, Melvin Colby was a strong leftist who conspired with the Futurians to keep anti-revolutionary science fiction out of circulation. Over a period of several months, Moskowitz had sent Colby about 100,000 words of original manuscripts to publish in Uncanny Tales, none of which Colby paid for, nor published, nor returned. Moskowitz concludes the story by describing an encounter with another one of the Futurians, John B. Michel, who said to him, and I quote, "Don't you know what we pulled on you?" end quote. And he explained that the Futurians had supplied Colby with the stories that he needed for free, provided he dropped Moskowitz, whose politics Colby didn't like anyway. According to Moskowitz, Michel departed almost bent over with laughter. Reading symptomatically, here's what I take from the story. The editor of Canada's major science fiction pulp magazine was a strong leftist who filled the magazine's pages with reprints of works by known socialists and communists in the American science fiction field, and strategically withheld from publication works of science fiction that were ideologically non-revolutionary. And that magazine was owned by Alec Valentine, one of Canada's most prolific pulp publishers. On its own, the story doesn't prove that Canada's pulp industry was a hothouse for proletarian politics. But when we consider it in light of the industry's independence from established Canadian culture enterprises, the theory becomes a bit more persuasive. And, of course, there's the federal government's strategic framing of the pulp industry as un-Canadian that we have to take into account. The War Exchange Conservation Act was nullified by the end of World War II, and soon American pulps returned to Canada's newsstands. Although this was devastating to a handful of publishers, and it spelled the end of magazines like Uncanny Tales, there were some pulp publishers whose success lasted through the 1940s. The Alval Publishing Company continued to produce pulp magazines in a variety of genres, as well as publishing comics and eventually salacious pulp paperbacks until the early 1950s. Superior Publishing, the longest-running Canadian producer of pulps, survived until 1956. So eventually, the Canadian... Ooh, hi, sweetie. That's my baby. Eventually, the government's interest in controlling lowbrow reading material ceased to be framed in terms of cross-border economics and started to be a matter of overt cultural integrity. By the end of the 1940s, Canada's elite responded to the ongoing production of pulp magazines with much paranoia about the alien American influence and the insidious threat these magazines posed to the moral development of Canada's children. Crime genres, in particular, raised the specter of pulp magazines as a kind of immoral American mass culture boogeyman, seducing readers into a depravity that was decidedly un-Canadian. It's crucial to know that Canadian pulp magazines were saturated with nationalist rhetoric. Michelle Smith explains that even though these magazines copied the form of the previously embargoed American periodicals, they did so while affecting a nationalist identity to set themselves apart from their American predecessors. Valentine's pulps, for example, used wartime rhetoric to make leisure reading a way of patriotically supporting the Canadian economy. Blurbs and ads stated, "Each issue was packed with the best stories that Canada's authors can produce. Get your copy today." And, "Edited and printed in Canada by trade union workmen on Canadian paper." Superior Publications, too, would emphasize nationalist pride and promise original Canadian content. For example, the back cover of the second issue of Science Fiction, a short-lived publication, it lasted three issues, devoted entirely to reprints of American SF, states, "This magazine is an all-Canadian product, printed and published in Canada and distributed by a Canadian distributing firm. By the purchase of this periodical, you are giving Canadians employment, Canadians who are paying taxes, buying war-saving certificates and victory bonds, doing their bit to preserve a free Canada and to maintain our prosperity." Further down the page, the promise is reiterated. "Ours are truly all Canadian magazines conceived, edited, and written in Canada by Canadians, adding to our country's business." The magazine was entirely made up of American reprints. Entirely. So, channeling my inner Hermione, I think we can look beyond the contents and consider how this nationalist rhetoric might have appealed or been intended to appeal to a working-class audience. The magazines seemed to go out of their way to identify with the working class, positioning those readers as front lines, producers and consumers of Canadian culture, irrespective of the heavy reliance on American content. Carolyn Strange and Tina Liu have further argued that Canadian stories published in crime pulps consistently promoted conservative Canadian nationalist values. Speaking to the moralism of Canadian true crime magazines, they argue, and I quote, "A detailed analysis of these crime narratives illustrates how Canadian pulps persistently conveyed the moral that sinfulness leads to earthly punishment. Every crime sprang from pride, envy, anger, greed, or lust. True crime stories were narrated with edgy dialogue and gumshoe argot, but they remained within and helped define the boundaries of heterosexuality, the racist tropes of moral hierarchies, and the certitude of explicable crime," end quote. So we can see how Canadian pulp magazines had the potential to contribute to the material and textual production of dominant 1940s and 50s Canadian culture, especially among the working class readers whose options for affordable entertainment were most limited. But the cultural and political elite were allergic to any interpretation of the pulps as Canadian cultural production. Michelle Smith contends that because of its physical characteristics, quote, pulp production generated a dynamic in which Canadian nationalism, embedded as content within a form of American-style mass culture, drew out fears about the Americanization of Canadian society. This meant that editorial strategies to replicate the American pulp magazine style in order to capture its Canadian market could be interpreted as, and I quote, American culture being replicated within the boundaries of the Canadian nation in a manner that eroded distinctions between American and Canadian literary culture, end quote. Now, in retrospect, we can argue that American pulp magazines developed their distinctive style over decades, whereas Canadian pulps had no comparable history or opportunity for development. But the federal government had many allies in its war on pulps. Religious organizations, voluntary associations like Kiwanis clubs, and public institutions like schools, libraries, and parent-teacher associations had been lobbying Parliament to make lowbrow reading, not literacy, but what people read, a matter of public concern. The argument these groups used was of the think of the children type, decrying the representations of crime and violence in cheap reading materials. Responding to these calls for action, Davy Fulton, Member of Parliament for Kamloops, BC, introduced a private member's bill to the House of Commons to amend the criminal code to categorize as obscene the depiction of crimes in pulp magazines and comics. According to Fulton, quote, this bill is designed to amend the criminal code to cover magazines and periodicals commonly called crime comics, the publication of which is at present time legal, but which it is widely felt tend to the lowering of morals and to inducing the commission of crimes by juveniles. Fulton's bill, I argue, provided for the members of Parliament and cultural producers invested in maintaining Canada's class stratification an opportunity to get rid of the pulps altogether. When reintroducing his amendment to Parliament after the 1949 federal election, Fulton clarifies that its target, quote, is not the ordinary comic strip in the paper, but rather what is commonly called the crime comic. In other words, the pulp paper magazine, which retails for about 10 cents, vast numbers of which can be found on any of our newsstands, end quote. Now, Fulton's definition of crime comic seems to be more a definition of pulp magazines in general than of comic books specifically. This was entirely in keeping with the total lack of discernment that members of Parliament had for pulp periodicals. The House of Commons debates over Fulton's amendment, which would ultimately lead to the criminalization of both comics and pulp magazines in Canada, were initially framed around concern over young people's exposure to pictorial depictions of violence. However, transcripts of these debates showed the discussion devolving quickly into hand-wringing over lowbrow reading culture in general, with only a surface interest in the circulation of comics. For example, Ernest George Hansel, member for Macleod, who positions himself as something of an expert on unwholesome literature, having compiled, and I quote, quite a file of this material over the past few years, end quote, conflates crime comics and what we might call tabloids in his remarks about the need for the amendment. He begins by describing a crime comic called Crime Does Not Pay, but then quickly moves on to another periodical called Girls on City Streets. At this point, he reminds the House that he has been building a file, and then describes reading, quote, an article on the life of a prostitute, end quote. Now, I assume this article was printed in the publication Girls on City Streets, but this isn't quite clear from the transcript, so there could be another periodical in question. Then, reminding the House of his file yet again, Hansel states, I did not obtain this merely to read. Of course, I had to read it, Mr. Speaker, or I would not have had the evidence. End quote. Neither Girls on City Streets nor the article Hansel claims he read for research are characterized as comics or even having pictures, suggesting to me that the purported anxiety over pictorial depictions of violence is in fact a campaign against the pulp magazine industry as a whole. In fact, so loose is the definition of crime comics during these debates that one member, Angus McInnes, abandons pretext altogether, stating, quote, I have received a number of letters and resolutions from organizations in my province urging that I support some measure, though not necessarily this one, to restrict the circulation of crime comics, or whatever we choose to call the sort of literature under discussion, end quote. The language used by members of Parliament throughout these debates relies heavily on concern over children's reading practices, and this is supposed to justify the scope of the amendment. Further, members of Parliament concur that it is not merely enough to censor bad reading materials, that action must be taken to encourage the right kind of reading. Roy Knight, for example, implores, quote, I suggest that instead of censorship or court action, we institute a counterattack by substituting things that are good for things that are evil. Let there be a cultivation of taste for good literature while people are still young. Let us give our young people better literature, end quote. Angus McInnes, too, laments, quote, the amount of trash offered for sale and the very small amount of literature that is worthwhile, end quote. Keeping in mind that these debates occurred while the Royal Commission on National Development in the Arts, Letters, and Sciences, which is more commonly known as the Massey Commission, undertook to inventory cultural production in Canada, it is clear that this was a period of cleaning house, culturally speaking. Crime comics and the alleged threat they posed to children provided members of the Canadian government who were concerned with refining culture an opportunity to get rid of the entire tawdry pulp industry. It is thus no coincidence that during the debate on Fulton's proposed amendment to the Criminal Code, an amendment that records show is only superficially about comics, members of Parliament take the opportunity to expound on Canada's need for a better literature, and, indeed, a Canadian literature, to define and unify the nation. Between 1949 and 51, the Massey Commission brought the matter of Canadian cultural production into public conversation. And, following its report in 1951, came a variety of government-sponsored institutions and funding bodies to support cultural production. But only high culture. According to Maria Tippett, a great deal of cultural production in Canada had been Americanized after World War I, including music, theater, and writing. Where am I? That is, like Canada's pulp magazine industry, high culture was greatly influenced by American cultural industries. With concentrated government support, however, most notably the Canada Council for the Arts, which was established in 1957, these American-influenced arts could be Canadianized and eventually make Canada an internationally acclaimed producer of arts and culture. But there were no efforts to secure the viability of Canada's pulp magazines or comic books or mass-market fiction published in paperback form. Fulton's bill had not only successfully marginalized pulp magazines and comics as American culture, undeserving of Canadian governmental support, it also ostracized that particular iteration of American culture as immoral and, therefore, criminal. Interestingly, Fulton would testify as to the inefficacy of Canada's anti-pulp legislation before the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency in the spring of 1954. According to Amy Nyberg's analysis of the hearings, quote, the law to ban the sale of crime and horror comics had proven ineffective in Canada. After it passed, that type of comic was replaced by what Fulton termed salacious material, and within the year, the crime and horror comics were back on the stands as well. Canadian law enforcement officials proved reluctant to prosecute retailers and distributors under the law, and the publishers were American and therefore not subject to Canadian law. Thus, the outcome of Fulton's bill was not the elimination of crime comics and pulps from Canada, but only the elimination of Canada's pulp magazine and comics industries. The mass culture circulating in Canada, therefore, remained dominated by American producers, ultimately proving correct the elite characterization of mass culture as American. The eradication of pulp magazine production from the Canadian cultural landscape had the added effect of marginalizing genre fiction wholesale as part of an American and therefore insurmountably un-Canadian tradition. And ultimately, this disqualified working class and young readers who were fans of mass culture from participating in Canadian culture. By framing mass culture as un-Canadian, Canada's political and cultural elite tied specific forms of cultural production to national loyalty. In David Ketterer's words, quote, "realism and naturalism were tools of nationalism. To describe the Canadian reality was, supposedly, to create the Canadian reality," end quote. This attitude produced a self-perpetuating literary tradition in which Canadian writers were obliged to publish their non-realist writing in American and some British venues. Canadian author Phyllis Gottlieb, for example, is quoted by Ketterer as believing her science fiction career to be, quote, "somehow un-Canadian, maybe even treasonable," end quote. I wish I could say that reading the Harry Potter series made me a better researcher, but that's not entirely true. This analysis of how Hermione models a critical and symptomatic reading only occurred to me when I started brainstorming for this keynote. But it has revolutionized how I understand my own research and method as reading symptomatically. Archival research, I have come to learn, requires a willingness to read everything without hierarchizing those texts based on genre. To understand the history of Canadian women science fiction writing, I consulted pulp magazines, slick magazines, fan-driven online databases, blogs, bibliographies and indexes, every book on American women's SF I could find, comic book dealers, used book dealers, collectors, scholars, government documents, and even a few academic journals and scholarly monographs. Any consultation I did with Canadian literary histories required me to read symptomatically in order to get a sense of the ideologies motivating the so-called understanding of Canadian culture. I already suspected that the history of English Canadian literature was an elitist one, and the fact that the majority of my research took place outside of CanLit's official narrative channels validated that suspicion. Archival research also requires an ambivalence about what we find. I was so excited about the science fiction stories that I found written by Canadian women. I was excited to read their nascent feminisms and imagined better worlds. I was excited to argue in my dissertation that their exclusion from CanLit was classist and misogynist, which it is. But I began this project with a great deal of naivete. As I read the stories, I realized that my project wouldn't be a celebratory recovery of lost Canadian women's science fiction. The texts are racist, and they advocate both explicitly and implicitly for a white, racially pure Canada, in precisely the same way as did the eugenic feminism of our famous five. The project thus became about the ways early Canadian feminists deployed science fiction as a discourse of white supremacy. It's a more valuable project than the one I'd envisioned, but a more complicated one, and that's okay. Hermione's research into the martyred Albus Dumbledore, revealing him to have been a young fascist, reminds me that it's okay if what we uncover makes us interrogate our own beliefs. Understanding the history of white feminism is something that we need in Canada, where so many of us deny our own racism. These early Canadian women's science fiction texts help me recognize white women's historical and current investments in white supremacy. Acknowledging pulp's classist erasure is a key piece of the puzzle, too. The answer isn't to leave the magazines in the archive, but to read them differently. To read them to understand the structures of power that organize our society through culture. And then we can do better. Thank you, and may the Fourth be with you.
So, Hannah, what did you think about my keynote?
Oh, so smart. So good. You're so smart and good.
Oh, thank you.
Do we have any closing business, or are we?
I mean, we're just off of any. Witch please off the rails, you know?
Yeah, witch please completely off the rails.
Ooh, you know what we can do? What? We can give the people something exciting to look forward to, which is an upcoming episode, which will come out sometime in the next couple months. Featuring everyone's favorite guy with a film degree.
So excited. I'm going to Edmonton for a week in August. Woo! and we're gonna record at least one and possibly two episodes with Neil. And I'm really tickled. I mean, I'm obviously tickled to see you.
You're gonna see me in 12 hours. 18. Yeah. 18.
Yeah, I'm really thrilled. So we are going to, recognizing that the schedule for season 3, since it is Witch Please Gone Rogue, is going to be irregular. Uh-huh. You know what? Episodes are going to come out when they come out.
Yep.
And bless those of you who have stuck with us.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to say a huge thank you to everybody who has donated through the link that we set up on the website.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at some point I will defy Marcel's orders and actually shout out the people who have donated so far. So if you desperately miss the Twitter lists and have always dreamed of having your name pronounced poorly on Witch Please, go ahead, head over to the website, owitchplease.ca, and click on the link that says Gringotts. You know what? You don't even need to click on a link. It just says Gringotts in the sidebar, and then it says amount, and you can donate a Dobby amount, which is $5 Canadian, or a Ginny Weasley amount, which is $10 Canadian, or a Hermione Granger amount, which is $20 Canadian, or, you know, the proudest feminist statement, you can donate a Hedwig amount, which is $50 Canadian. Yeah, that's right. I created a hierarchy of feminism and equated it with monetary value. I'm the worst.
Oh my God, this is the radical and aggressive feminist agenda at work right here.
Yep, absolutely. Don't forget that if you ever want to buy any Witch Please merch, you can do that at society6.com/owitchplease. And you can look forward to seeing some new items in that store at some point this season, both because I am designing a thing and also because I have somehow convinced my friend who is better at graphic design than me to turn my ideas into things that don't look shitty. So
cool.
Look forward to that.
Listen, your things don't look shitty. They look beautiful.
They're beautiful. And I am definitely going to complete and post my sound effect collage, which is very beautiful. But you can also look forward to a Malkoy design some point in the future, and hopefully to a No Tall Men, despite the fact that my friend who is doing the graphic design is a very tall man. And was like, can you explain this joke to me? And I was like, maybe.
Hashtag not all not tall
not
men.
All tall
not all tall
not all
men.
Tall men. Yep.
You know what?
What?
If 100 people donate.
Jesus fucking Christ, what are you about to sign us up for?
I will read the names of monsters giving us money.
Oh my God. Oh my God. If 100, that's it. Mm-hmm. If 100 people donate,
yeah.
Marcel will read your names. Let me just
like as see. Painfully as I can possibly manage to do it, because know that I hate it.
She'll mispronounce your names. We are currently probably somewhere around 20.
Oh my goodness.
So
yeah, so 99 or fewer and you get Hannah's beautiful mellifluous voice doing it, but 100 or more and I will suffer. I will suffer through everyone.
Oh my God, you can make this happen, folks. It's only $5. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to Season 3, Episode 2 of Witch Please.
Witch.
Please?
Please? Never gets old.
You can find the rest of our episodes at that website I already mentioned, owitchplease.ca.
Special thanks, as always, to our erstwhile tech support and the robot of our hearts, Trevor Chow Fraser.
Hi, how are you? Sorry, I'm just going to do the sound effects now.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, how are you doing?
That's good. That sounds like Trevor. No, it doesn't. All right, so we will be back in an unknowable quantity of time. to bring you another episode that will be roughly the same amount, if not more, unhinged. But until then,
later, witches. It's what you've always wanted, people.
This is, you asked for this.
You said you wanted us unedited. This is it.
Oh, God. Okay, I'm pressing stop.
Great.